been a health hazard for years, but now some relief may finally be coming to its victims. Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Charles Griggs in for Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9, and make sure to subscribe to us on podcasts on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, a legislative claims bill has been filed in hopes of providing relief to former employees impacted by a local hazardous waste site. To get in on the conversation, give us a call at 549-2937. Then later, local celebrities are taking to the basketball court to defeat homelessness. We'll get the details from the I'm a Star Foundation about the Jack's Helps celebrity basketball game. Also, organizers come together to highlight services for caregivers of military personnel and veterans. Plus, student filmmaker Alana Taylor is here to talk about her award-winning film, Astronaut Starbright. And Cole Pepper is here to talk about the Jaguars-Patriots game yesterday. But first, give us a call at 904-549-2937. Here in our first hour, we're going to be talking to State Senator Audrey Gibson. After years of back and forth from former employees, a now defunct hazardous waste site may be in line to receive some much needed financial relief if a bill successfully makes it through the Florida legislature. State Senator Audrey Gibson, who will also be serving as incoming Senate Minority Leader, recently filed a legislative claims bill to provide $10 million in financial support to workers impacted by contamination at the Fairfax Street Wood Treaters facility. The facility has been closed since 2010, but according to the claims bill, workers were subjected to high levels of arsenic to treat wood without the benefit of protective gear or information related to the risks posed by the health hazards out there. Joining us to discuss this claims bill legislation and future outcomes related to the health concerns out there is State Senator Audrey Gibson. Senator, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me this morning.
Thanks for being here. So tell us first, how did you get involved with this legislation and what was going on in the community that spurred your interest in helping the citizens?
Well, let me give you just a little history. My grandparents owned a home on 17th and Fairfax, which is right at the beginning, I guess, of the wood plant. You would make a left. And so I've seen it gone from, I think it was a feed mill, to what it ended up being during the time that the individuals or the group of individuals that I filed a claim on behalf of came. And so I started attending some of the meetings they were hosting at EWC, and then sent staff when I couldn't be here to learn more about what had actually happened back in the day as I was passing that place, as a matter of fact. And so you laid it out very well essentially, the part of the neighborhood more on the backside where the water flowed was being poisoned.
Yeah. So what does it mean? What does the claims bill mean? What is the purpose of it? I know that you that there's $10 million that you're looking for. What exactly does that mean to the former workers, employees over there?
And so it is to compensate them and some who may have heirs because of being parents or grandparents who have descendants whose genetics, if you will, may have been impacted by the arsenic. And so I spoke with an attorney who's helping them to try to figure out where he came up with the $10 million. And so the estimate is based on the number of employees who over time work there, mm-hmm. and at roughly about 100,000 per employee, and okay. Some of them were very young. Mm-hmm. So,
what have some of the former employees of the facility been saying to you about this claims bill?
It's largely been the group that has been there, and some of their descendants as well, and that is they noticed illness within their families, and that is certainly unacceptable. The state And the federal government actually came to realize that when it rained, the chemicals would run off into the yards where kids were playing and where people were planting and where people were living. And so I think your question went to the arsenic and the other chemicals that were there created a safety hazard and certainly impacted their quality of life.
So I noticed in the bill itself, you mentioned some of the regulatory agencies that service the community, the Department of Health, the Department of Financial Services, and Department of Environmental Protection. What have they had to say about the claims bill itself, and are they in support of it? And full disclosure, I used to work for the Department of Health.
And I remember that. And I haven't personally yet spoken to the Environmental Protection Agency folks, mostly just those residents and their descendants who were there. And so part of bringing forth the claim bill, and hopefully it'll get a hearing. It's a process, and it's never been in court before. So it's going directly to the state in the essence of time. Mm-hmm. And so those things will be discovered as I make the presentation, and certainly implore my colleagues to pass the claim bill, and then for it to get paid, actually.
Yeah, so this is a little different than the normal legislative process. So talk a little bit about that, because I think people may be expecting for you introduce a bill, you can get it through your chambers, and then the House has a version of it, and it gets through there, and then it gets signed into law with the governor's signature. What's the difference between that and this?
Well, generally, something has happened and there's been a settlement. Like, I've filed some other claims bills before, and there's generally a settlement, and the claimants have received the a certain portion of it, and so then they would come to the legislature asking for the balance of a claim. Let's say it's $1 million, and they got the $200,000. So they want to come to the legislature to get the balance. It's been settled. It's usually a settled claim.
Yeah. So what about, I'm going to go back to some of the workers, the former workers there. What about other people in the community? Because you mentioned that there was runoff and the workers may have been exposed. What about those people living in the community? Is there any plan? Are there any plans for any type of restitution for them as well?
Currently, not in this claims bill. They continue to meet to see if there are other things that can be done on the behalf of the people who currently live there, and certainly cleanup of the site, which certainly falls under the Environmental Protection Agency. And there are folks in Atlanta who have come. I dealt with a situation similar on the east side, where we had meetings to try to get cleanup done. There has to be a deep dig in the soil to go down underneath the contamination.
Then what a call is 549-2937 to get in on a discussion. We're talking with State Senator Audrey Gibson about the legislative claims bill that she has filed to provide relief to former workers of the Fairfax Street Wood Treaters Facility. And you said you had relatives or you knew people who lived in an area, and there may be larger conditions there. What do you expect to see after the bill is completed, run its process? It seems like this would probably perhaps spur more people to come out and ask for this type of relief going forward for other sites in the community.
And I think, let me just remind you that it's very difficult, particularly in an unsettled claim. And it all depends on, I think they already have a sense of how far and wide the contamination went. And so it will be a pretty defined area, which legitimately it should be. At the time, it was like 1980 to 2010 approximately. And so there are about 100 people who were working there. This is all the information I asked the attorney for. I ask a lot of questions because I wanted to be right. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to know the premise for the amount he was asking for to spread across the employees. And so, on the north side, there were many contamination sites. And I think the tennis court there near the Emmett Reed went on for years and years before finally the money came to certainly dig deep, as I said earlier, and then cover it over with the concrete for the tennis courts. Mm-hmm. And so cleanup can be done. It's the process that really folks shouldn't have to go through, because the city knows and the state knows what happened there.
So what do you see as a future for it? I mean, what if you had your way for the entire contaminated area? What would you like to see? I mean, what would your vision for it be based on what the citizens are telling you they like to see?
Well, I'd like to see those who whose families are currently impacted to be not only have their health coverage. The state at a minimum should provide some sort of health coverage. And that sounds like a bill I might have to think about for people who have gone through such contamination and their heirs. When you have been wronged by a governmental entity continuously who certainly knew what was happening, they have to get a permit in order to be able to operate the facility that has to go through the governmental channels, then you have to do what's right by people.
Okay. All right. Well, I have you here. I'd be crazy not to ask you, incoming Senate Minority Leader, what are your thoughts about your vision for the upcoming legislative session?
Ooh, vision. multiple. And I think that first and foremost, my job is to elect Senate Dems. I talk about bringing balance to the legislature. That's my first vision, because when we have balance in the legislature, we have better policy, and all voices rise instead of just a few. So, I have a couple of things I want to look at. I certainly want resistance will come, and that's okay. I think we need to look back at that Stand Your Ground legislation that was changed in 2017. And also education is big for me, particularly college education. You know, we have this debate about choice. Well, everybody has choice of where they want to send their student. But after that, if you're going to college, what happens after that? Whether you go to a traditional public school or a charter school, what do those numbers look like? And what is the need-based aid number? I appreciate how we have really beefed up the money for those who are receiving Bright Futures. Mm-hmm. But I do think we need to look at some of those components, like summer school. Need-based aid kids need a summer school time too. And I think we should look at funding that as well as a book stipend. So,
okay. Those seem like worthy challenges. And I know people on the other side of the aisle would probably challenge some of those. The number to call is 549-2937 to get in on the discussion. We have a call. Jay's on the north side. Jay, good morning.
Good morning. Senator Gibson, I hear you talk about the Fairfax area. What about the area over here on the other side, over here by the Legion field, where I got some contamination? Now, first of all, I got a letter from the city that said it's going to clean it up by the summer's end. And so far, I haven't heard anything about it. Do you know what's going to happen on this side?
On the city side? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you at first.
Jay, can you repeat the question real quick?
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I got a letter from the city. They said it's going to start cleaning up in midsummer. But I haven't heard anything else more about it. Do you know anything about it? Now, I heard you talk about the Fairfax side. What about over here on this side, over here
By Legends Field.
Yeah, I think you said something about Lonnie Miller Park, yes. Your Legends Field.
Lonnie Miller Park.
Okay, thank you. I have not seen that letter. I'd be interested in seeing that. Obviously, the city has not contacted me about any cleanup that they're doing over there. But I've heard, of course, over the years that they were going to do cleanup over near Lonnie Miller Park. So I'd be interested if you could call my office so I can get a copy of that letter.
Well, if I don't see you there, I can see you otherwise. You know who I am. I'll contact you at another place.
Let me give you my number. It's 904.
Okay.
359.
359. Okay.
2553. And I'll be in the office shortly.
Okay,
very good.
You're welcome.
See, there, you know, there are obviously a lot of people in the community who are concerned about various contaminated sites. And it seems like your bill is one measure to move forward on some type of relief for those people who've been suffering over the years, especially being heard. Do you think that there are going to be more on the horizon?
Well, and the part of the difficulty is timing. It's, you know, generally there's a statute of limitations, but certainly any individual in the community who feels like they have suffered from poisonous chemicals or from landfills should certainly come forward and we can see how we can get to helping them individually, specifically. But the funding for brownfields, that pot needs to be bigger,
mm-hmm.
Not only at the federal level, but as it comes to the state. And I believe we can systematically, certainly most of them are already identified, but certainly make more progress sooner towards cleanup and what that looks like. It's not a simple process.
Yeah, so that begs the question, what has the collaboration been like for state, local, and federal entities who have to work together to remedy the problem? Because, you know, Jacksonville has had a significant problem with contaminated sites historically. What do you think, are you getting the cooperation you're needing on the federal level, and are you getting the cooperation you need on the local level? To find a relief for the type of relief citizens are looking for.
Well, if you think about it, the site on the east side took an extremely long time. And part of it, I call it corporate tricks, is due to, let's say, somebody files bankruptcy like they did. I can't even think of the name right now. Over on that east side property. And I went to a number of meetings over there. And then there's some state lands, submerged state lands that are involved. Once the company went bankrupt, then somebody else bought it, and it's like starting all over again. So not only is it a process to get it cleaned up, because there's a lot of testing that has to take place. There's testing of the soil, digging down deep, and then making sure you find who is ultimately responsible.
Yeah. So your answer to citizens who are writing letters, making phone calls, is to be patient with the process, because that's what's going to help them find relief.
I know that sounds absurd. Yeah. They've been patient over the years.
It can be frustrating.
It's very frustrating. It involves money, like I said earlier, and it does involve collaboration of all levels of government. And sometimes that has been a little difficult.
Yeah. So again, I'm going to go back to the legislation, because you got that coming up, and this is a unique situation. We haven't had someone here locally with your leadership going into the upcoming session as some Senate minority leader. There's a chance that you could end up being a Senate majority leader.
That would be the president.
That would be the president. So,
Well, it's a very exciting time. Voters are motivated across party lines, actually. If you think about it, there's been one party domination in the Florida legislature for nearly 20 years. Mm-hmm. And as I said earlier, when you don't have balance, all voices don't come up, and their issues aren't addressed. And I believe, even in a situation like this, with this contamination, if we had balance in the legislature, we would be much farther along in terms of what we need to do on contaminated property. So I'm excited about the prospects of four to tie, which is still a win, and five in the majority. And it makes a difference. And like I tell people all the time, it matters who represents you.
There'd be a shift in priorities, definitely, if,
absolutely,
if you became Senate President.
Healthcare, for sure, number one. We have nearly a million people in this state who don't have insurance.
Yeah.
And we turned around billions of dollars to help us, help them, and other people.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank State Senator Audrey Gibson for coming in this morning and discussing and with us on First Coast Connect. And make sure you, for those citizens out there who are not tuned to this issue, to stay tuned to it by she's invited you to come by her office or call to get more information.
Yes.
Senator Audrey Gibson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
I'm David McGowan, CEO of WJCT. By now, you've probably heard one of the spots we've been airing as part of our Radio Uninterrupted campaign, asking you to support the wide range of great programming you hear on air. None of us like extended pledge drives, but we don't exist without your support. So we're trying something new and asking for your contributions with these short spots. Call 353-9528 or go online now at WJCT.org and help us shorten pledge drives. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Andrew Rickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. There has been reported more than 3,000 homeless students in Duval County Public Schools. The Amistad Foundation, a youth-led organization, is working to support homeless students by providing resources and scholarships to help them succeed. This Saturday, the organization will host the fourth Jax Helps Celebrity Basketball game to raise funds to continue supporting homeless students. Here to discuss the homeless students and this weekend's event is Dr. Priscilla Jenkins from the Amistad Foundation. Good morning, Dr. Jenkins.
Good morning.
Well, tell us a little bit about the game and why it's necessary. First, tell us about the numbers of students who are actually out there who are homeless and who are attending public schools.
Well, as you mentioned, there are 3,000 homeless students, but those are 3,000 students who are reported that they are homeless. They are more than that, but those who have decided to come forward and report, they're 3,000 students. And based on this large number of students, there are about 1,870 elementary students, 790 middle school students, and 817 high school students, again, who have reported that they are homeless. And the Amistad Foundation is a student-led organization, solution-oriented. The students saw the problem with homeless students and wanted to be advocates for students.
Okay, and so in this situation, they they decide to advocate for supporting homeless students versus some of the other areas that they're prominently known in regarding health and wellness as well.
Yes, there's Jacksonville Help is just one of our signature programs.
Okay.
We have some other programs as well, but this Jacksonville Helps is such a needed program for students who are homeless and helping them in a number of ways. We have partners who are working with us. We have we're looking for Platinum Star members who that is $5,000 and above.
Okay.
Who work with us to provide that $5,000 and above goes to book supplies, helping seniors with scholarships, furniture for families who are in transition from being homeless, phone cards, tuition, just a number of things.
Mm-hmm. So it's got to be very impactful for the students to receive the support that you give them, especially in light of the fact they're probably not expecting it. Most of these students are in a situation where they feel like they're not going to be receiving support, or they don't have anywhere else to turn because this is one of those gap situations. Tell us about one of the scholarships, some of the students who've been receiving scholarships. How does that work?
The process is we work with hand in glove with the Duval County School District and with their homeless department. We find the students who we have a list of students, finding out what those needs are for the homeless students. If they need, if they're seniors, we look at working with them and where they're going to attend college, what type of scholarships they're going to need, making sure that they have funding for scholarship applications, admissions applications. These fees are costly.
Okay.
So providing those kind of supports for students. Something for the first time was unique on Saturday. We did, because there are 3,000 homeless students, we did a 3,000 for 3,000 moment.
Okay, very good.
And I think that was very impactful for not only the homeless students who were there, but for the community as well, to come out and see that there is a group of young people, their peers, who are supporting their efforts to say, we hear you. We hear you. We're here for you, and we're supporting your efforts.
Okay. Now tell us about the game. This is the fourth time the game has been put on, and tell us about the game and what are you looking to achieve for Saturday evening?
The game is a very exciting opportunity where we have celebrities playing against, as the students like to call them, old school, playing against high school students, which is very exciting. The students, of course, have always been the winners, and the celebrities have done a tremendous job in this effort. It's good sportsmanship. What we're hoping, the students have set a goal for to raise $37,000 to give back to Duval County Schools for Students.
Mm-hmm. Now, who are some of the celebrities participating in this game?
Some of the celebrities participating in this game. Let me just start off with our cheerleaders. We just had a few minutes ago State Senator Audra Gibson.
Okay.
She is a cheerleader. Representative Tracy Davis, Councilmember Joyce Morgan, these are some of the cheerleaders that we have. Now, for the best celebrity side of the basketball game, we have Councilman Bill Gulliford, Councilmember Reggie Brown, we have people from the Sheriff Department, and we have our very own celebrity.
Yeah, why am I playing if you have celebrities?
You're with the 100 Black Men and Mr. Griggs. And I think it's just a fun time for students to get out and see the interaction of community, because it's all for one cause, and that's for the students.
Yes, it's a lot of fun. I can tell you I've participated in all three so far, and it's a lot of fun. And it's one of those things where the entire community comes out and has a chance to root on. And we really like to see the young people win. That's the reason why the celebrities haven't won a game yet.
I'll take that.
Dr. Jenkins, thank you very much for being here, and we look forward to seeing the game Saturday. And for those who want more information, where can they go about the get information about the game?
If they want more information about the game, they can go to the website www.imastarfoundation.org, and that's imastarfoundation.org, or they can call 904-924-0756.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Jenkins, and I look forward to seeing you Saturday out there at the basketball game. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Look forward to seeing you as well.
All right.
Please come out and join us.
All right. We'll be right back.
WJCT's fundraiser is on right now. Did you know that? You didn't know it because we're not interrupting our programming. We need your help to raise $60,000, and we want to do it without interrupting programs. There's no need to wait. Just give now. Donate today at WJCT.org/radio or call us at 353-9528 to support programs like First Coast Connect, 1A, Fresh Air, and the Electro Lounge. Help us keep your public radio uninterrupted by making your donation at WJCT.org/radio or call us at 353-9528. Our goal is just $60,000 before September 28th. Help us minimize the number of days we fundraise on air. The drive ends when we reach our goal. So call 353-9528 or go online right now at WJCT.org/radio.
Welcome back. Providing caregiver service to active or retired military members is unlike the experience of any other caregiver. This Friday, the Caring for Military Veterans Caregivers Conference promises to provide important information on special services for those engaged with caring for those who have served our country. Here to talk to us about this is Tula Wooten of the Caregivers Coalition. Good morning, Tula.
Good morning, Charles. Thanks for having me again.
I'm glad to be here. I know that caregiving itself is a tough job. What makes it so different to care for military personnel or active military or veterans?
That's a great question. Obviously, there are a lot of commonalities. Caregiving, as you said, is a very tough job. It can be physically, emotionally, spiritually, and financially depleting. For those who are caring for someone who is a veteran, there are often other factors that come into play. As you know, many of our heroes suffer from PTSD, mm-hmm. and that can be ongoing from World War II, Korean War vets, our Vietnam vets most certainly are suffering, and our most current heroes. And so that puts a different factor or play into place, if you will. There are a lot of emotional things that the caregivers are often really have a hard time dealing with. That veteran who's experiencing nightmares and sweats and trauma and anger. There are just a lot of different things that make it a whole lot harder. But the beauty is there's a lot of resources to help the caregivers of veterans that often they don't know about.
I think that most of the time when we think about caregiving, we think of older people like our parents that we're challenged with caring for in their latter years.
Right.
But for active duty personnel and military veterans, there may be considerably younger.
Often they're considerably younger. We have a lot of returned heroes here in Jacksonville and parents in their 40s and 50s caring for their adult son or daughter who've experienced trauma, who've been in combat, who've maybe lost a limb. It's ongoing, the number of things that can happen. This conference will focus on the caregiver of our younger heroes as well as the older veterans, because there's a lot of programs, again, to help them.
Yeah, so talk to us a little bit about some of those programs, because I know that you mentioned that some of them are sort of, you know, people aren't really used to the typical types of programs that you may be talking
yeah.
about, because you know, we just don't think about them because of the range of services that need to, that are out there.
Yeah, there's so much. And, you know, I like to tell people, actually, that the Veterans Administration really leads the country in caregiver support. They have more robust programs than any other caregiver program that I've met with. There is something called the VA Caregiver Support Program. You can actually Google that. One of the things they offer is in every VA hospital, there's a caregiver coordinator who's there to support the caregiver, not the veteran, but the caregiver, and help meet their needs at all levels. Here in Jacksonville, we have our wonderful City of Military and Veterans Affairs, and they have programs, of course, to support the veterans, but they lean on the Caregiver Coalition of Northeast Florida for additional support in supporting that veteran, and they give help to the caregiver. We have the Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregiving up in Americus, Georgia. She founded that about 35 years ago, and she has a real focus on the military and veteran caregiver called Operation Family Caregiver, and one of their speakers will be here this Friday for the conference to talk about how they support caregivers. Just a lot out there.
Yeah, and the Caregiver Coalition is a point, an entry point for many of these services that are being provided at the conference. What do you hope to achieve at the conference this Friday? Because this is, you know, an important opportunity to share that information. But right. at the same time, you want to have some takeaways. What are you looking to achieve there?
You know, we will have 5 to 6 different speakers who will offer, again, information, education to these caregivers to help them in their day-to-day role, support the services I've already talked about. And we'll also have about 30 vendors that represent organizations that support both the veteran and the caregiver. So I hope that they come away with new information on resources to help them. Plus, something that I think is really important is connectivity to another caregiver. I always encourage caregivers to find someone who's going through the same things you are. There will be a discussion called Wounded Warrior, Their Last Battle. This is going to be done by Deborah Grassman, who is the nation's expert on caring for veterans at end of life. Veterans at end of life, particularly those who experience combat, often undergo some psychosocial, emotional things during their dying experience that the rest of us don't have. Mm-hmm. And so she will talk about how to bring those veterans to a place of peace so that they can die peacefully and comfortably. It's going to run the gamut from younger to older and how to support veterans of all ages.
Now, this isn't just for caregivers. Now, you want the general public to attend as well, because Jacksonville is a military town and our military community is very important to us.
Absolutely. We've invited people from both bases. We've invited a lot of people in the healthcare community. As a matter of fact, there will be CEUs for nurses and social workers and nursing home administrators. And so we'll have people right on site to make sure that that happens. Caregiving is a topic of national importance now, and we really want to bring it to the forefront, particularly this Friday for caregivers of military and veterans.
Okay. Tula Wooten, thank you for being here. It's the Caring for the Military Veteran Caregiver Conference, the Family Caregiving Conference. It'll be Friday, September 21st, here at the WJCT Studios, 100 Festival Park Avenue, and it starts at, the registration begins at 8:30 a.m. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
All right, next we have up here with me in the studio is a film about a young lady's quest to promote science and technology, engineering and math among young ladies of color. 15-year-old filmmaker Lana Taylor directed and produced a documentary called Astronaut Starbright, a film featuring Taylor Richardson, a high school student with aspirations of becoming an astronaut. The documentary is off to a great start, too, right?
Yes.
The film will be screened at the All-American High School Film Festival and the Hollywood Independent Filmmakers Festival and Awards. Joining me to discuss the film and the documentary is Lana Taylor. Good morning.
Hey, what's up?
All right. You tell me. Tell us about the documentary. How did this get started? What made you want to do this particular documentary?
Yes, well, okay, so me and Taylor knew each other in elementary school, and, you know, we had a connection, and we kind of reconnected over the course of a couple years, and my mom had a great idea about doing a documentary on her, and I was like, wow, it's actually a really cool idea. Why don't we go ahead and do that? And so that's kind of, like, what started it, and, you know, with the documentary, you can't really, like, you know, plan everything out because a documentary goes like the way it goes. So throughout the documentary, we were just like getting the story and going along. So.
All right. All right. So how long have you been doing films?
I have been, well, I have been interested in film almost all my life. So I've been doing like ill professional films.
Almost all your life, you're 15.
Yes. I mean, yeah, I was really into it starting at age like 5, 6.
Wow. I mean, most kids are watching films at that time. They're not thinking about producing them. So, you know, what did that, what was that like? I mean, did you have like a, did you do something on your phone and you say, hey, this is cool, I want to do it more? Or did you see something, a movie or a documentary that inspired you?
Yeah. So, okay. I liked writing at the time. And unlike most people, what was very different about me is I would like think of a scene and I would view it in my head as a film. Like it, in my mind, it would play as a film. And that was like a thing. Like I'd always get these film ideas. Mm-hmm. Like my teachers would always call it Lana Land because I'm totally not paying attention to math. I'm paying attention to this movie I just came up with. And
how's that working for the grades?
Yeah, it didn't do very well, but they're good ideas.
What's inspired? Motivation.
Mm-hmm. And with my neighbors, I would like to get them along and I would like direct it because I loved being in charge. And we would just make these films in my neighborhood about like these ideas that I came up with.
Okay. So tell us about your film. And I know that you said it's about Taylor Richardson and her quest to become an astronaut. And she was motivating other young ladies to get involved in STEM. But what actually, what do you expect to see out of this? I know that you have the, tell us about the film festival. What do you actually expect to see out of the production of this?
Well, I really love Taylor's message that she's trying to get across with her Astronaut Starbright thing. It's kind of the whole point of the documentary. I really wanted to show to a wider audience her and like what she's doing because I really do believe in what she's doing. So I hope that this film can come across to as much people as possible so that they can understand the importance of Black girl representation and just woman representation in general as well.
So what about the events, I mean, the nominations for the film festivals, what does that mean to you?
It means a lot, really. I mean, as a freshman in high school, it's very cool, I think, to get in awards, and especially Austin, which is really cool. And it really does mean a lot to me, you know, like I never really expected it. So it's really cool.
So if you get, you're looking at winning some awards, and what's next if you win awards from the documentary?
Well, if it wins awards, it gets more recognized. So it's probably going to go some places, hopefully. We've submitted it to other festivals. So hopefully it gets recognized there. And just my main goal for it is for it to reach as many people as possible for that point that I want to get.
So we have a pretty energized film community here in Jacksonville with the film festival just happening over the last weekend.
Yeah.
What do you see for, what kind of response have you gotten from the local film community?
Well, I'm a film student, so I am not really in the film community. I'm just more involved with...
That's okay.
I'm more involved with my school and like our film community there.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. So, Lana Taylor, thank you very much for being here and good luck with the film festivals.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours, available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
High Tide Burrito Company, local since 2009, caters to hungry employees and bosses with fresh, made-from-scratch Mexican food for lunch or parties. No more same old. Menu and ordering at hightideburrito.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Neil deGrasse Tyson. His new book is about the unspoken alliance between astrophysics and the military. He says the Trump administration's plan to create a space force, taking over what the Air Force already is doing in space, isn't crazy, but he'd add a few other things.
I throw in, hey, why don't you defend this against asteroid strikes? And how about cleaning up the space garbage?
Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
A new public history concentration is being offered at Bethune-Cookman University in Daytona Beach. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll visit the historically black college. We'll discuss the history around the Apalachicola River and talk about vanished Sanford. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
The numbers are not good. 10 million people in the Carolinas and Virginia under severe weather warnings. 5 million live in the potential path of Hurricane Florence. We'll probably measure what it leaves behind in feet rather than inches of rain. We're following Florence next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, all of the buildup to the Patriots-Jaguar game proved to be just that. It was a brawling hot on the field, but Blake Bortles was even hotter, and the Jaguars showed they are Super Bowl contenders.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper is here to give us thoughts on what the Jags fans will be discussing for days. A 31-20 win over the New England Patriots. Cole, good morning.
It was quite a scene at the stadium yesterday. Let me start with the way it felt. You mentioned the heat, but it felt, heat notwithstanding, like a playoff game in terms of the atmosphere. The fans were into it. The fans were ready. Sometimes you can hear the fans. Sometimes you can feel the fans, and you could feel the excitement of the energy yesterday. The noise felt different, and I think that made a difference right away. The Jaguars got off to a hot start. The Patriots thought they would be the ones to get off to a hot start. It happened just the opposite. It had been something like 35 games since the Patriots had allowed a first drive touchdown. But the Jaguars went right down the field, scored on their first possession to take the lead, and never looked back. Blake Bortles had maybe his best game ever, 29 of 45 passing, 377 yards, four touchdowns, one interception. One of those catches was an amazing catch by Keelan Cole. I think it's the best pure catch in Jaguars history.
That was a great catch. I was listening to the game on the radio, and I could feel the heat through the radio. It's so hot out there, and but it seems like every time people expect for Blake Bortles to have a bad game because he didn't do so well. He wasn't so great last week, right? He was in an average game. This week he was phenomenal.
And it was interesting because talking to Blake and to other players after the game, they all thought that they were going to win this game because they had a good plan, because of the way they prepared, because they were ready. There was a great confidence about this team going into this week. And sometimes you can be confident and then you go out and you don't play your best. But the Jaguars really played very well. It's the first time that the Jaguars have ever beaten Tom Brady. They got some revenge for the AFC Championship game loss as well. Although one thing that Bortles said after the game was he didn't really think of it as a win over Brady as much as a win over the Patriots.
I've never really looked at it like that as far as beating Tom Brady. You know, I don't play against him. We play against their defense, and he plays against ours. But, you know, it'll, you know, for sure be cool. You know, he's a no-doubt Hall of Famer to say that on this day we beat Tom Brady.
So the Jaguars now 2-0 for the first time since 2006, if you can imagine. They did it without Leonard Fournette, who did not play in the game. We'll see what his availability is for this week. Cam Robinson left the game and did not return. Knee injury reports are that it could be an ACL and he could be out for the entire year, which would mean the Jaguars are going to have to turn to Josh Wells or maybe somebody else at left tackle. They did get big plays from Keelan Cole, from D.D. Westbrook, and from Dante Fowler, who had a strip sack and recovery of a Tom Brady fumble at a key point in the ball game after the Jaguars had turned the ball over. So a lot of guys making plays in this one for the Jaguars. Next up, they'll face the Tennessee Titans, who come to town on Sunday. And there's a chance, by the way, that the Titans could be quarterbacked by Blaine Gabbert in that game.
Yikes. So that's, you know, they've exercised one demon, so to speak,
the Patriots, and now they got to try to get another one because they lost to the Titans both times last year. And it seems like they just have some kind of mojo over the Jaguars.
Well, last year, both of those games, I think the Jaguars, for one earlier in the season, when the Jaguars were kind of going win-loss, win-loss. The second one late in the year, New Year's Eve in Nashville. I was there for that one. Bitter cold game. Mm-hmm. Jaguars basically missed on one play that really changed the game. That was a Derrick Henry touchdown. So a lot to be proven this week. The Titans are 1-1 after beating the Houston Texans. So if the Jaguars win this game, they'll certainly be in good shape. Remember, there are only five teams who have started 2-0 in the AFC. The Jaguars, the Dolphins, Bengals, Chiefs, and Broncos. By the way, the Jaguars, Dolphins, and Buccaneers, all three Florida teams, 6-0 combined, which is probably a good thing considering the way the college teams are going in the state of Florida. Florida 2-1 after beating Colorado State. Gators travel to Tennessee on Saturday. I like Dan Mullen as a coach. I think he's got some things going. I don't think he's got all the tools that he's going to want, but I like the way he has handled coming off the loss to Kentucky and the way that they played. On the other hand, Florida State is going the other direction. It is a real mess. Their only win is against Samford. They lost to Syracuse for the first time since 1966. They'll host Northern Illinois this weekend. You would think that would be a win, but I don't think there's anything as a gimme putt right now for Syracuse. And then Miami 2-1 after losing to start the year. So the big three in the state of Florida, 5-4 in their first nine games.
Wow. A lot of people are preaching patience, but it takes a lot when you have those types of fan bases.
No doubt about it. I think Florida's fans are probably feeling a little bit better than the Seminoles fans are right now. And of all of them, I think Miami probably the most unsure of what they really have this year with that group.
Up and down, up and down. Okay. Thanks a lot, Cole.
Thanks, Charles.
All right. Thanks for being here. And that's going to do our show. Before I get off the air, I'd like to say rest in peace to Rita Perry, who's the publisher of the Jacksonville Free Press. We lost her over the weekend. Our producer is Kevin Mershott. Michelle Corum is on the board. Thank you very much. The show's theme is composed by Pia Chefchik. And 1A is up next. I'm Charles Griggs, in for Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM. Jacksonville, your community, your world. Jacksonville Daily Record reporter David Cotton will be here tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Well, there you go. Another First Coast Connect, a great program. But this is it. We're only have a few days left to reach our $60,000 goal for the WJCT Fall Membership Drive. And we're committed to reaching our fundraising goal as quickly and as interruption-free as possible. So give now at 353-9528. Because here at WJCT, we're working hard to fundraise without interruption. 353-9528.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.